Okay, welcome back, everyone. Hope you had a good weekend. A couple of quick reminders before we dive in. Our next homework is due this Friday. It should not cover any of the state plane type analysis. It's nonlinear capacitances and switching loss, the things we covered through last week. And state plane analysis covered in next week's homework as we get into it. And then just a reminder of options to participate in lecture. Since we've had a couple of silent lectures, I just want to remind everyone, I've got Slido open on the monitor over here to my side. If you want to ask anything anonymously or asynchronously, go to slido.com and enter the code ECE581. If you don't mind being de-anonymized, you can use chat or unmute at any time and ask a question, but feel free to chime in, slow me down, ask questions as needed. Can be a little more difficult with these remote lectures to find a time to jump in, but hopefully one of these options is workable. Feel free to use them. Okay. So let's dive in. Last time we did this introduction to state plane analysis, we motivated it by saying, hey, in these converters, there's going to be a lot of cases during switching actions or during certain switching periods, switching subintervals, where we have some sort of resonance. And as we push towards higher frequency and some of these soft switching type designs, that resonance can be significant to the converter operation. Things like the resonance that occurs during the dead time in the synchronous buck, they're always there, whether you design it 1 kilohertz or 10 megahertz. They tend to become more significant as you move towards higher frequency and push towards a more optimized design. Very standard, non-optimized designs, they're there, but they're 0.1% of the overall period and don't really affect the solution. Go up into the megahertz switching frequency range, they're 10% of the period and they greatly affect the overall waveforms and really need to be considered to have a good idea of what this converter is doing. And we looked at a couple of example cases and found that for a lot of the typical converters that we're familiar with, we can kind of reduce down during these resonant periods to an AC equivalent circuit that looks like a single inductor, single capacitor, and perhaps some voltage and current sources as bias. These equivalent circuits are not unique. Once we start making these AC simplifications, means that we have reduced the circuit in some way and that reduction is in general not unique. So we kind of showed a couple of different ways on the buck and the buck boost. On the buck, I put everything in parallel with this low side device capacitance. In the buck boost, I started by putting everything in parallel with the high side device capacitances. I could have done the opposite and kind of mirrored what I did with the buck and put everything in parallel with the low side. It's my choice there. AC is maintained because it is an AC equivalent, but by its nature, an AC equivalent means it doesn't have the DC part. So as long as we keep track, we can use any of these AC equivalents. Once we solve the AC, as long as we know how to relate that back to the DC solution, fine, pick whatever one you like. Often it's easiest to keep in key waveforms. For this buck converter, I generally prefer to put everything in parallel with the low side devices because that means V switch will still be part of my circuit. But put it all in parallel with high side device, V switch won't be in there anymore. I'd have to do some derivation to get it. Okay. And then last time we kind of showed a derivation of the state plane analysis by looking at an example circuit and going through and solving the differential equations, getting the full time domain solution for this one inductor, one capacitor circuit. Generally going to end up with, because it's lossless, is some sinusoidal response on both elements. We have some sort of phase and amplitude, or we just have some sort of cosine and sine terms with different amplitudes associated with them. We found that if we normalize things in a certain way, and that specific way is to pick whatever V base we want, divide all the voltages by that, and then pick an I base that is our V base divided by the characteristic impedance of the circuit. And that's constrained. V base can be anything. I base needs to be this once you selected that V base. If we normalize in that way, what it does is a nice thing with the amplitudes of these sines and cosines. It makes it such that they're equalized in a way where we get the equation of just a circle in our MJ plane. And we show we can go through and plot that circle based on the results of this analysis. But where we ended was we said, okay, now that we've done that once and understand how it works, we really don't have to do that differential equation step anymore. We can jump straight to this point. All we need to know from our circuit, once we've derived this AC equivalent, is where's the center of the circle, and that is the DC solution. Where is the single, you know, we need one point somewhere. Now that we know that this is a circle, we just need one point on the outside of it. One we can most readily get is the initial condition. Once we have the DC solution and the initial condition, our circle is defined. The only other thing we need is an initial condition on the derivatives to get the direction. So tell us whether we are going around this circle clockwise as time progresses or counterclockwise as time progresses. So if we take our AC equivalent and we just find those three things, DC solution, initial condition, and the initial direction, then done. No need to go through all these differential equations. We can plot this thing, plot this circle in the state plane, and begin using that to analyze parameters of interest of the circuit. Okay? And I want to do just a quick example. I'm going to use this same generic circuit that we used here. On the next slide, and I'm just going to show how we might solve a couple parameters of interest of this circuit. Okay, this one was just a generic resonant circuit. It didn't really, we didn't specifically associate it with any power converter. So what we need to solve on it's kind of arbitrary at this point. But just as an example, I'm going to look at saying, okay, from our initial condition and our DC solution here, what is the peak inductor current, and at what time does that peak inductor current occur? And show kind of the benefit of the state plane analysis is how simple and easy it is to solve these kinds of things. Okay, so I'll do that on the next slide here. I'll say we again have something where our DC solution is here on our M sub C, J sub L axes. Our DC solution was MDC. And JDC. Oh my gosh, this is worse. And we have some initial operating point that we solved from the circuit. On the previous slide, I drew it up here in the top right. Just to do something a little bit different, I'll draw it somewhere down here. Here's my initial condition. Call it M naught. J naught. This is my DC solution. MDC, JDC. Okay. Try something out real quick to see if it'll get rid of some of these spurious lines. Nope, it's already done. So I want to, just as an example, solve two different things. What is the peak inductor current from this circuit? And then when and in time does IL peak occur? So I've got some resonant circuit. I want to know the peak of the inductor current and how long after t is equal to zero does it take before I hit that peak current. Okay. And we'll just look at the first time, say it's oscillatory, it'll be another period afterwards it hits that same peak current. Okay, so I'm going to do that using the state plane. And let's start here. So since everything is normalized on the state plane as we're going back and forth between real parameters of the circuit and state plane parameters, we're always going to need to either normalize or denormalize. Right. So IL peak, we're going to find by finding on the state plane, what is JL peak, the normalized peak inductor current. And we know from our normalization that that is IL peak over I base is IL peak over V base over R naught. Okay. So if we can find the normalized peak inductor current, then we can simply multiply by this normalization factor to get back into our IL peak, our unnormalized, our value in amps. So I want to come over here and find it on the state plane. Let's say, I have to put a direction associated with this, but let's say our direction is clockwise around this state plane. So where does the peak inductor current occur? Well, it's pretty simple. We can just see it on the plot since JL is just normalized IL. It's just a scaled version of it. The maximum value of JL is still going to correspond to the maximum value of IL. So this point right here is our maximum normalized inductor current, J sub L peak. And it's going to happen after, as I go rotate or spinning around this circle as time progresses, it's going to happen after I go through some angle theta peak to get there. Okay. So since it's a circle, I'm going to keep a constant radius and I'm going to be kind of rotating clockwise around, spinning around this circle. If I go theta peak after time t is equal to zero after my initial condition, I'll get to this point where I'm directly above the center and I have the peak normalized inductor current. So then all I need to do is solve JL peak, plug it in here and get IL peak out of it. So what is JL peak? Well, it's whatever this radius is, same radius as my initial condition, stays constant above JDC. I can say JL peak is JDC plus R, whatever this radius is. And then that radius can solve with some simple geometry here. I'm just going to look at this triangle formed by my DC solution, my initial condition, and this radius. And I can find this radius by Pythagorean theorem. So I can see here the width of this triangle is the difference on the m-axis between my initial condition and my DC solution. It's going to look like mdc minus m naught. The height is the difference on the j-axis between my DC solution and my initial condition. It's going to look like jdc minus j naught. So then r squared is the sum of the squares of those two sides. So I can say JL peak is JDC plus R. R is the square root of MDC minus M naught squared plus JDC minus J naught squared. And last step, just rearranging this kind of first line here, I can solve for IL peak. I'm going to multiply I base into the result of the previous line or multiply V base over R naught. So it would look like V base over R naught times quantity JDC plus square root MDC minus M naught squared plus JDC minus J naught squared. And done. There's our peak current. So when we had this initial condition and we normalized it to get M naught, we add our DC solution, we normalized it to get MDC, same thing for JDC and J naught. We can now go through and solve IL peak. Okay. Next thing is we didn't have to do any kind of circuit analysis, differential equations, Laplace transform. All we had to do was plot this circle and solve it with geometry. Okay. Next, the question, when does this peak occur in time? So what we recall from our normalization is that angles like this theta peak are omega naught times the corresponding times t peak. T peak would be the time between t is equal to zero and when the inductor current reaches its peak. So again, all we need to do is solve an expression for theta peak in terms of known parameters and then divide it by omega naught to get this time. Okay. So theta peak we can solve again just looking at the plot. Looks like it's 90 degrees plus whatever this angle is here. Let's call that phi. And again, using some basic trig this time, looking at this triangle here, I can solve phi a few different ways now that I know r, but I'll do the most straightforward one, which would be the arctangent of this height, which is again JDC minus J naught, over the same width, MDC minus M naught. So I can say theta peak, this full angle looks like pi over 2 plus phi, which is pi over 2 plus arctan of JDC minus J naught over MDC minus M naught. And then if I want to get back into my non-normalized domain, T peak is theta peak over omega naught. It's going to be 1 over omega naught times pi over 2 plus this arctangent. Okay. So again, arbitrary examples for some generic resonant circuit, but shows an example of how to look at the state plane and solve quantities of interest off of it. If we wanted to find peak voltage on the capacitor, we could do it in a very similar way. We'd just be looking at this point, solving an expression for it, or minimum voltage, anything else. What is the voltage and current after a given time? Be the inverse of the way that we solve for when does IL peak occur. Just say, give it a time, normalize it, see where the states are after that angle. So perhaps a little bit arbitrary at this point, but from there we're going to move into actually looking at applying this to converters and solving for real quantities of interest or solving full waveforms of the circuit. Just an initial example here. So just by way of review, I want to list out kind of what the approach is, what the algorithm is to apply state plane analysis to some converter circuit. So state plane analysis is going to be useful when we are able to manipulate the circuit into an AC equivalent. with one inductor, one capacitor, and DC sources. Saying possibly we don't need them. So state plane, you can plot for really anything, but it's going to be principally useful when this normalization works, when it results in circular trajectories or a combination of different circular or straight line trajectories, things that basic trig and geometry will apply to. Okay. I mentioned before, if you can't do this, if you have multiple different capacitors and they cannot be described with a single AC equivalent, what you end up with on a state plane are either ellipsoids or kind of spirograph looking things. You can plot those, but it's not super useful for analysis because you can't just look at it and write down a solution like we could for this circular trajectory. Okay. So this may require some approximation. And likely will require some simplification of the circuit. And you want those approximations to be well-founded. For example, back here, AC equivalent, definitely these two capacitors are in parallel because this is a DC source. But we did approximate this capacitor away, got rid of C out. If we didn't, we'd end up needing to analyze with the second capacitor and bringing in a resistor in. Talk in a moment about what resistors do to the state plane, makes things more complicated. So we're trying to stay in undamped 1L, 1C circuits. On their own, very simple to analyze, but as part of a larger power converter, can require some effort. Okay. Assuming we've done that, we're able to simplify down and get this type of a resonant circuit, then the steps for state plane analysis are, first we normalize everything. We normalize according to V base is equal to anything. Then I base is constrained. I base is V base divided by the characteristic impedance of the resonant circuit. And then any times of interest. Well, let's put our normalization equations here. So we pick these two base quantities and then we normalize M sub C of T is, well, really anything, let's say just M sub X of T, any voltage we care about is equal to that voltage divided by V base. Most often we're looking at the voltage on the capacitor in our equivalent circuit, but we could look at anything else. So all of our waveforms get normalized in this way. Our currents normalize to J sub X, comes from I sub X divided by I base. And then our times become angles related to the resonant frequency of the circuit. So resonant frequency is going to dictate the frequency of these sines and cosines. We'll go through a single period of resonance every 2 pi over omega naught. On the state plane, we'll make one full circle around this every 2 pi. They correspond to one another. So after we normalize everything, then we are going to plot the MJ trajectory, plot our waveforms. On the MJ axes. That is our state plane. We're almost always plotting M sub C, J sub L, quantities of interest, and the things that will form a circuit with another, with each other, are the normalized, will form a circle with one another, normalized capacitor voltage and normalized inductor current. And look at other voltages. These are the two that we're going to plot and make a circle out of. That trajectory is going to form a circle. And that circle is going to be fully characterized by the three quantities. It's going to have a center. At the DC solution. What is the value of the capacitor voltage and inductor current that will cause no ringing, cause it to just sit there and stay constant? It's going to have a point on the circle itself at the initial condition. And the state plane always has a trajectory associated with it, a direction associated with it. That's going to come from the initial condition on the first derivative. So at time t is equal to zero, what is the gradient of the capacitor voltage and inductor current, increasing or decreasing? So once we've done that, we can sketch out this full state plane, and then we can solve any parameters of interest off it. This is the main advantage of this approach, is that we can solve those more or less graphically with a little bit of trig, a little bit of geometry knowledge. And then in our final step, once we solve things on the state plane, all we need to do is denormalize. So we're applying the inverse of these equations up here to get back into our real voltages, currents, and times. So that's how it works. More often than not, rather than reducing the entire circuit down to some equivalent, we're going to be looking at inside one switching interval, inside the dead time, it becomes this equivalent circuit. Use that to supplement analysis where we don't need to consider the resonance. So our synchronous buck, for example, we may design that such that when the high side switches on or when the low side switches on, we can apply small ripple analysis everywhere. It's just during the dead time that we need to really consider this resonant behavior. So then we're combining together resonant type intervals with linear type intervals. Almost never will we have this circle be the complete picture. There'll be some segment of this circle that describes one interval and then some other behavior after we switch. So, a quick animation here. Not sure how well this will show through Zoom, but the idea behind this, just kind of graphically, so we have some time domain circuit resulting in this resonant behavior, showing some current up top and some voltage down low, and we're only interested in some segment of that, really. Okay, so this would be like our dead time in the buck converter, where the voltage resonates from DG down to zero at the switch node. So we're just interested in the part of this resonance that's actually going to show up in the circuit, this little arc here. Okay. In state plane analysis, what we do is we scale those things according to V base and I base until they're of certain magnitudes where we'll have this nice cancellation and they'll end up becoming a circle. And then we plot them with respect to each other. If I take these two sinusoids, kind of rotate 190 degrees, I can see this segment becomes the variation in J. This segment becomes the variation in M, and that's some portion of a larger circle in the state plane. So that's the idea, leveraging some known behaviors of certain circuits, we can reduce this differential equations problem into geometry. Okay. So let's look at actually applying that to a converter. So we'll start with probably the simplest case, this DCM buck converter. It's gonna operate very similar to the DCM boost that we talked about in the introductory lectures, just flipping it so that it's a buck instead of a boost to do a little bit of variation. Okay, so I'm gonna look first at a specific case, M is equal to a half, where here M is V over VG. So I'm saying my output is VG over 2. And I'll assume L and the switching frequency are sufficiently low such that this thing goes into DCM. We're gonna look at the waveforms for first just the ideal case, and then we'll start looking at the impact of capacitances on its operation. Okay. So I wanna look at three waveforms, look at the switch node voltage here, the inductor current, and I'll look at the diode current ID. Right. And I'm gonna set start by assuming everything's ideal. And all this TS, and we'll just use our 481 type analysis. There's no parasitics. We're operating in DCM, but we can get the whole solution by averaging, taking into account DCM. We need to average the diode current. When we go into DCM, we end up with three subintervals per switching period. A third one comes because we have no devices conducting. So in DCM, in subinterval one, the MOSFET is on, call it M. Subinterval two, our diode turns on, the inductor current ramps down. And if it hits zero before the end of the interval, then we get this third subinterval where we have nothing conducting. X meaning nothing. Okay. So the basic operation of this thing in DCM, what happens? Switch node voltage, when M is on, it still pulls it up to VG. When the diode is on, it pulls the switch node down to zero. We'll just do these first two intervals first before we talk about interval three. For the inductor current, DCM, we should start at zero. And we'll ramp up during this interval, making our averaging a small ripple approximation. We have a slope of VG minus V over L ramping up. Assume when we're looking at the inductor current, the output voltage is more or less constant. So we get the MOSFET on, VG and V on the other side of the inductor applied across it, so the slope. Then the MOSFET shuts off, diode turns on, and we ramp back down to zero with a slope of minus V over L. And the diode current is just the inductor current during the time that the diode is on. So it'll look like this half of that triangle. So then, without considering any parasitics, what happens in this interval three? You know, nothing important to the converter because all the switches are off. But as we try to sketch these waveforms, DCM, we say the inductor current stays zero, or the diode current stays zero until the end of the period. The switch node voltage is a little more weird. You may recall from 481, where does the switch node voltage go? Well, if we're going to claim that the inductor current remains zero, then it had better have zero voltage across it during that entire interval. It's got V over here, so it would have to have V over here, which means that the switch node voltage jumps up to the output voltage V. Oh, kind of red is the ideal case for all three of these waveforms. What we're going to look at is, okay, how is this behavior modified when we include the impact of different parasitic elements? And so I'm going to include capacitances of all my devices. I'm going to have some diode capacitance, some drain to source capacitance of this MOSFET. I may have some winding capacitance on my inductor. I may have some kind of additional parasitic capacitance just from my PCB between the switch node and ground, or between the switch node and VG. And I'm going to include in the analysis now the impact of all of these capacitances. Okay. All five of the capacitances that I've drawn here, as we talked about before, go between the switch node and some other node that I'm going to be able to approximate as DC, the ground, the input, or the output. And again, assume C out is big enough that I can assume the output voltage is constant, or approximate the output voltage as being constant during any single interval. Okay. So with that, I'm going to use state plane analysis to figure out what happens during this interval where both switches are off. Okay, so if I include the impact of this capacitance, find that if the MOSFET is on or the diode is on, it basically shorts out all of these capacitances. Either get shorted to zero or shorted to some DC voltage on them. So they really only come into play in a significant manner with respect to looking at my waveforms during the interval where both switches are off. Any time where both the MOSFET and the diode are off, such that the capacitances can resonate. Okay. So when both M and D are off, my AC equivalent circuit. Again, this is not unique. I can make some different assumptions, keep different waveforms in it, but I like to keep the switch node voltage in there. So I'm going to simplify like this. D, L, I'll call this C switch. C switch is my net AC capacitance on the switch node, so that'll be CDS in parallel with CD, in parallel with CW, in parallel with CPCB1, CPCB2, every capacitance that goes between the switch node and some DC node. Okay. So they all go between one AC node and one DC node. I can put them all in parallel for my AC equivalent circuit. Again, so it's not unique. But this is the one I'll look at. Nice thing about it is it keeps the switch node voltage and the inductor current as part of this AC equivalent. Okay. And then I'm going to analyze this thing using state plane analysis. So let's kind of look at the behavior of it. I'm going to specifically focus on this interval right here. interval 3. When I start including the effects of these capacitances, really two things that are going to change about circuit operation. As we kind of go through in interval 1, when the MOSFET is on, all those capacitances are shorted out. Including their effect, though, would change what happens in between interval 1 and 2. I can no longer, when I have capacitance on the switch node, make this approximation that the switch node voltage falls instantaneously. Instead, we'll have this circuit show up, some resonance between the inductor current and this capacitance that causes this voltage to fall. Okay. So there is now some additional interval in here, call it 1B. That one, generally speaking, is a little bit less impactful because we've got a whole lot of current, our peak current in the inductor. And you kind of blast and charge this capacitor really quickly in most cases. So we'll loop back, particularly when we look at the synchronous buck converter and analyze this interval as well. But for the moment, I'm just going to focus on looking at 3 because interval 3 is longer. And during all of interval 3, we have no devices conducting. Okay. And 2, with the diode on, all these capacitances will be shorted out. So it's really here in 3 and a little bit in this 1B that we see this equivalent circuit where both devices are off. So I'm going to focus here and just look at 3 on the next slide for my state plane. So I'm going to do the state plane during the subinterval 3. So I'm going to be looking at this time right here as my initial condition. So this is t is equal to 0 for the state plane. So look, this time, look at my initial condition here and my DC solution. So starting with the DC solution. Hey, how do I get this circuit to just sit there and not have any oscillatory behavior? Well, since there is no current source, I'm going to need my inductor current to go to 0, and I need my capacitor to block all of V. So V switch is V, that puts 0 voltage on the inductor, so it can stay steady. And if the inductor current is 0, then there's 0 current in the capacitor, so it can just hold its value. So my DC solution will be V switch is equal to V and IL is equal to 0. Once we normalize that, that'll become the center of my state plane. And then my initial conditions. I'm going to look at what I've labeled here, our T is equal to 0 point, right as we go into subinterval 3. So my initial conditions are switch node voltage is equal to 0. Coming from subinterval 2, it's down at 0 volts. And the inductor current is equal to 0 as well. In addition to my initial conditions on the states themselves, I'm also going to look at the initial conditions on the first derivative, which are going to tell me the direction on the state plane. So this is all, and at what I've labeled T is equal to 0. So my initial derivative on the switch node voltage, okay, because initially in this circuit I have 0 inductor current, there's 0 current flowing through the capacitor, so initially switch node voltage is not changing, no current in it. My initial derivative on the inductor, however, because this capacitor's initial condition is 0, and I have this voltage source V, means that initially the inductor is going to have some DIDT. It's got a voltage V applied across it in the opposite polarity is how I've labeled IL. So this is going to be minus V over L. All right. So before we go and plot the state plane, let's just think conceptually about what's going to happen to these waveforms during subinterval 3. Now that we've solved all this stuff, we're most of the way there. So the inductor current has an initial derivative of minus V over L going into this subinterval 3. And the switch node voltage is initially flat. From that initial condition, we've got this resonant circuit. It's going to resonate around a DC solution with V volts on the capacitor and zero current in the inductor. So what we're going to get, depending on the frequency and time, is something that looks, let me draw that a little better, something like this. Where the inductor current and the capacitor voltage are going to resonate with one another, the out of phase sinusoids. Starting from the initial condition, you can see this is kind of a negative sign on the inductor current and a negative cosine like kind of waveform on the switch node voltage. Using state plane, we can find the exact details of these waveforms. We'll do that on the next slide. Okay, what about the diode current? And this again comes down to how we've created this AC equivalent circuit. So here, the diode current is no longer part of this circuit. It got absorbed into this equivalent capacitance C switch. So in order to find it, what we need to do is kind of undo that equivalent that we did. Basically, we know that C switch is this parallel combination of all these capacitances. So the diode current will be some fraction of the current flowing through C switch according to the ratio of impedances here. Basically, the diode current is going to look like the inductor current, but it'll be smaller magnitude because it's just one piece of the current flowing through this switch node capacitance, which is IL. We could pull it back out just by looking at the ratio of the CD impedance to the overall switch node capacitance impedance. But by doing this equivalent, we've lost it explicitly. It's no longer part of this circuit. And we have to go back and look at how we constructed that equivalent if we want to find that diode current. There's a question in chat, is the green V-switch waveform purposely drawn to reach VG? Yes. And we'll see that on the state plane in just a moment. Way I knew that it reached VG is in my mind I thought about the state plane. But basically, this M is equal to 1/2 is going to be a special case where V-switch exactly reaches VG but does not exceed it. And after we plot this state plane, we'll look at the M is less than 1/2 and M is greater than 1/2 cases. Okay. So next thing I'm going to do is plot the DCM Buck state plane. We've only got a minute of lecture left, so I won't actually start drawing that. We'll pick up there next time. We'll plot the state plane for this subinterval, and then we'll look at, said, the operation when M is anything other than 1/2, in which case find that the green V-switch waveform does not exactly reach VG. It's either shorter or it tries to be taller. If it tries to be taller, it'll end up turning on the high side body diode of M and get clamped, introducing another switching interval. Okay. So we'll pick up there next time. Go ahead and